Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Thursday, December 11th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. It's good to have you with us. On today's show, we'll talk with Cynthia Nickerson about pre-diabetes issues. Donna Hurley and Mike Wilson will discuss the Light Flight fundraisers. And we'll get a preview of Tuesday's Mudroom storytelling event. Those interviews, National Native News, Bird Note, music and more right here live and local on a Juno Afternoon. It's currently 43 degrees with rain, fog, and mist here in the capital city.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Officials with the company that wants to build an open-pit copper and gold mine in southwest Alaska say people should give their new plan a chance because it calls for a smaller mine and they don't plan to use cyanide to get the last bits of gold out. Native people who depend heavily on salmon for subsistence remain dubious. They say protecting the water as a cultural resource is critical and hope the federal government considers that before making a decision about mining in the area. Today we end our five-part series, Alaska Water Wars, taking a look at development and Native communities. Dacia Eaton reports.
Native people in villages who rely on salmon for food and cultural practices are skeptical. Like Crystal Jensen, city manager for Ekwok, a village of about 100 people located on the Nooshigak River, midway between the proposed mine site and Bristol Bay. Jensen, who is Yupik, says she believes a mine of any size will mess up subsistence.
Without our subsistence, we'd be starving. I'd say 75% of our subsistence is fish.
Elders just upriver in Nustuyahok, a village of about 600, agree. Timothy Wanhola says any size mine is just too risky.
Every year we put up fish. I've known about it since I was small, and now I'm an adult, and I'm having children that are having their children and still living in the same culture. It hasn't gone away, and it will if something happens.
Alana Hurley, who is Yupik, lives in Dillingham and works as a commercial fisherman, also leads United Tribes of Bristol Bay, which was formed to fight the mine. She says they're ready to fight on every available front.
We are preparing, and we'll do whatever it takes, whether it's in the courtroom, whether it's laying in front of bulldozers.
The EPA has received more than 1 million comments on the issue, most supporting protection of Bristol Bay. Hurley says that doesn't surprise her because Bristol Bay is known around the world for its wild salmon. But she says it's not just about fish as food. To Hurley and others, it's about a cultural right to do what their ancestors have done for thousands of years.
This is an indigenous rights issue that all people should be concerned about.
The EPA issued a statement that said it will consider all public input before making a decision. The Pebble Partnership plans to bring on a new investor and file for permits soon. In Anchorage, I'm Dacia Eaton.
The Hopi tribe in northeastern Arizona recently signed a gaming compact with state officials. They're the 22nd and final tribe in the state to sign such a deal in hopes to boost revenue. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
Former tribal chairman Herman Honani signed the 20-year agreement as one of his last actions in office. It allows the 15,000-member Hopi tribe to operate up to 900 Class 3 gaming machines on Hopi land or lease them to other tribes in the state. The Bureau of Indian Affairs still has to approve the deal. According to the Arizona Department of Gaming, revenue from tribal casinos in the state was nearly $2 billion in the 2017 fiscal year. Hopi officials say the gaming compact could generate millions for the tribe as it faces an uncertain financial future with the closure of the Navajo Generating Station in 2019. The 2,250-megawatt coal-fired plant provides a significant portion of Hopi tribal revenue and employs hundreds. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by Canyon Records, producer of Native American music, including Radmila Cody's Kehasin, Kinship and Hope. All Canyon titles available from iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, and CanyonRecords.com. Support by Ramona Farms, wholesome and delicious heirloom crops for a better diet to benefit all people. Christmas delivery of foods from our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions available on orders placed by December 15th online at store.ramonafarms.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're tuned in to a Juno afternoon here on Monday, December 11th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host today. It's about 6 minutes past the top of the hour, and in the studio with me now is Cynthia Nickerson. She's a certified diabetes educator and RN over at Bartlett. Welcome to the show, Cynthia.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. Okay, so I understand you have a program called Health Matters coming up, and it has to do with basically diabetes prevention.
That's correct. It's for people who are at risk for type 2 diabetes and those who have a condition called prediabetes, which puts them at higher risk of developing it.
Okay, so we're going to learn about this year-long program in a class coming up on December 18th to learn more about this. But take us from the beginning, Cynthia, if you wouldn't mind. What's the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes?
So type 2 diabetes is the most common form of diabetes. About 90 to 95% of all persons with diabetes have type 2. And several things are going on in the body that makes the body resistant to digesting food and managing blood sugars the way it should. So people who have type 1 diabetes have had an issue with their pancreas. So the pancreas is an organ that sits behind their stomach, and it produces a hormone called insulin. Insulin is key to managing and regulating blood sugars. So for those folks, the only thing they can do is inject insulin and manage their blood sugars with food and exercise, balancing all those together.
And which one's genetic?
Type 2 is considered genetic.
Okay.
If your parents have type 2 diabetes, if both of them have type 2 diabetes, you definitely have a higher risk. If you have one parent that has diabetes, then you do have an increased risk.
Okay, and I've heard you say the word prediabetes a few times. How does one develop prediabetes?
Well, prediabetes is a precursor of type 2 diabetes. So just about everyone who develops type 2 diabetes will at some point develop something called prediabetes. And that's a condition in which the blood sugars are elevated, but not yet high enough to get that diagnosis of diabetes, and specifically type 2.
Is there an age range where you see this happen to people, a common age range?
Yes, actually, as we get older, our bodies are just not as efficient as they once were. Right now, it's half of people age 60 and over have prediabetes, but, you know, we're seeing so much more diabetes, or prediabetes in general, so we're seeing people in their 40s, 50s also develop prediabetes.
And are there lifestyles that lead to prediabetes?
Well, like you said, it is genetic, but then there are some triggers that can kind of help type 2 diabetes come out, and we know that those are things like inactivity, being overweight or obese can put you at higher risk. Smoking is a risk factor. We think pollution is a risk factor as well. So there are actually many different possible triggers for type 2 diabetes.
And what are symptoms?
Symptoms of type 2 diabetes, I think the worst one of all is no symptom at all. So a lot of people are very surprised. They feel fine, and they come in, and they really, it's hard to convince them they have diabetes.
And how can you tell? Just the elevated blood sugar?
Yes, okay. An elevated blood sugar, a blood draw from your arm at your doctor's office. But a lot of people will complain of having, like, blurry vision, maybe going to the restroom very frequently, feeling tired, or maybe having a wound or a cut that doesn't heal properly.
Interesting. Okay. So thinking about this Health Matters program that's coming up and what people can learn more, I guess outline that for us.
Well, Health Matters is a program that was developed by the Centers for Disease Control to help people with prediabetes turn it around and actually get rid of having prediabetes. It's reversible. Actually, it's the only time in a person's life that they can actually get rid of it. So once you get the diagnosis of diabetes, you have it for life. And so what the CDC did is they came up with this program which incorporates learning about healthy foods, healthy ways to prepare food, portion sizes, also helping people increase their exercise. The current recommendation with the program is 150 minutes every week. And then there's also a weight loss program included. And we're looking for participants to lose about 5 to 7% of their current weight. And all those things working in conjunction with each other can help people reduce the risk of developing type 2 diabetes.
Okay, so I understand there's an informational class coming up on the 18th, is that right?
That's correct, at Bartlett Regional Hospital at 5:30.
Okay, so you can go and learn more about this class. Again, tell us a little bit more about the details. You said it's a year long. How often do people meet? Where do they meet? What do they do? That kind of stuff.
So at the very beginning of the program, participants will meet once a week for 16 weeks. And that will be the heart of the program. And then we pare it down to every other week. And eventually we end up with just one meeting a month. And that's just kind of making sure that people are still on track, that they're still, you know, doing what they need to do to get rid of this prediabetes. So it is a commitment, and it's not a quick fix by any means. It's really taking control of your health and making lifestyle changes to improve your health.
When you do, like, let's say those first 16 weeks every week, is it as a group? Is it one-on-one with a counselor? How's that look?
It is as a group, and we've been really fortunate in that this is going to be our fourth year of this program, and in the past, we've been able to get people all out together as a group exercising. We went to the pool. We'd go to the Diamond Fieldhouse and go walking together, and it's a really fun way to meet new people, to support each other with these new changes that you're trying to develop. And so it is as a group that we meet.
I'm reading here that type 2 diabetes risk can be decreased by up to 58% and up to 71% for those over the age of 60 by taking a course like this.
Yes, so you can see it's quite successful.
Great. If somebody suspects that they have prediabetes, what should they do?
Talk to their doctor and ask about a blood draw to find out for sure. That's the only way to tell.
Okay. Okay. If people want more information about, the first class or the whole thing, where should they go?
They can go to the Bartlett Regional Hospital website, or they can call me at 796-8649.
And get your pencils out. We'll do that number again in just a second. About how many people took this last year? Do you remember?
Well, we actually had two classes going on at the same time this last year, and we keep the classes set to no more than 18 people per class.
Let's say there's somebody listening right now that does have prediabetes. How would you convince them to take this class?
How would I convince them? I would say, now's your chance. This is it. So, you know, I joke, but I kind of mean it, that I'd really like to be put out of a job with, you know, a cure for diabetes and for anyone who has prediabetes to get rid of it so you don't end up in my office.
Okay. That's the voice of Cynthia Nickerson. She's a certified diabetes educator and registered nurse out at Bartlett Regional Hospital. You can meet her in person on Monday, December 18th. At 5:30 and learn more about this year-long program called Health Matters. Cynthia, thank you for coming on the show. Is there anything else that you'd like to add? And give us that number once more, please.
My number is 796-8649. And again, this is for anyone who is ready and willing to commit to improving their health and just living a better life.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Oh, help me, please, doctor. I'm damaged. There's a plane where there once was a heart. It's sleeping, it's a fading. Can't you please tear it out and preserve it right there in that jar? Oh, help me, please, mama. I'm sickening. It's the day, that's the day of the plunge.
cried my mother as she plied me with bourbon. So sour. Pull your socks up, put your suit on, comb your long hair down, for you will be wet in the hour. So help me, please, doctor, I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. I'm sleeping, it's fading. Can't you please take it out and preserve it right there in that jar? Yep. Oh, help me, please, doctor, I'm damaged. There's a pain where there was a heart. It's sleeping, it's fading. Can't you please tear it out and preserve it right there in that jar? I was trembling as I put on my jacket. It had creases as sharp as a knife. I put the ring in my pocket. Red,
darling, I'm sorry to hurt you, but I've no courage to speak to your face. But I'm down in Virginia with your cousin Lou.
Now be no waiting to die. So help me, please, doctor.
The Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is holding a public open house about a traffic study for the Fred Meyer intersection at Egan Drive and Yendukin. It's on Tuesday, December 12th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Mendenhall Valley Public Library. At 5:30 p.m., the project team will present traffic study data, explain preliminary intersection design concepts, answer questions, and listen to ideas and concerns. Meeting details are on the project website at alaska.gov/go/CWGK.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, December 11th, about 20 minutes past the top of the hour. Scott Burton, your host today. And now in the studio are a couple of folks going to be talking about the Light Flight on December 15th. We have Donna Hurley. She's the president of the Mendenhall Flying Lions. And also Mike Wilson, GM of Coastal Helicopters. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thank you.
All right. Donna, why don't we start with you? The Light Flight, if somebody hasn't heard of it, what is this?
Oh, it's a beautiful helicopter ride through the Mendenhall Valley to look at all the Christmas lights on the houses. And it's a benefit for the Children's Tumor Foundation.
Okay. And the Mendenhall Flying Lions Club, of which you're president, tell us a little bit about other things that you do in the community.
Well, we do recycling of eyeglasses. We do free eye screening in all of the grade schools, preschools, Head Starts. We try to do most of the towns in Southeast. Sometimes traveling's a challenge. Two food banks. If it's volunteer work, somebody's involved.
Okay, and you're the one that meets Mondays? And remind us when you meet.
First and third Wednesday of
Wednesday.
Every month.
Okay, and where?
Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church.
Okay. All right, Mike. GM of Coastal Helicopters, how long have you guys been participating in this?
Well, we started it, I want to say it was in 91 or 92.
Okay.
And we partnered up with the Lions, I believe it was in 2003.
Okay.
And it's been a great partnership ever since. So last year was the first time I think we've canceled in their history. So.
Oh, why'd you guys have to cancel?
The weather last year. There was freezing rain and just it wasn't a good day.
All right, so Coastal Helicopters, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're the helicopters that are mostly yellow and white?
Yellow, yes.
Okay, mostly yellow. Tell us a little bit about what you guys do here in the community.
Well, we've we've been a utility supporter of the community since we started in '89, and so we work with we do a lot of tourism now. But in the spring, we also do another fundraiser for the Cancer Connection as well.
Okay.
So.
And when you say utility supporter, I think I've seen your birds with the baskets underneath, like going up to mountains or helping out AEL&P or that
right,
kind of work.
Communication and power support for sure. Communications, AT&T, AP&T, AEL&P, a number of different communities. We worked with CORE from the beginning.
Okay. How would you guys say, if you had to break it down between tourism and utility support, how would you do that?
I was just looking at those numbers this year. It used to be 70-30 utility and tourism. Now we're about 50-50 with the growth of tourism in Juneau.
Okay. Thinking of the light flight coming up on December 15th, which is, it's the 11th. Is that Friday?
Friday.
What time?
4:30.
4:30 to 7:30. Yep.
And where do people meet?
At the Juneau Airport, and we're in the old terminal, gate 1.
Yeah, the north wing, where Alaska Seaplane's main counter is now.
Okay, and we'll come back to those details again here just in a second. Donna, have you ever taken this flight?
Yes, I have.
Explain it to some of our listeners. What's it like?
It's dark. I'm afraid of helicopters. But it's really pretty. I mean, Juneau goes all out in the valley. Everybody is sure that, they're home and their lights are on. And fewer and fewer complaints every year that we do it about the noise of the helicopters and more satisfied residents that have gone up. Of course, the kids are always happy that Santa arrives on the first helicopter. We have good word he'll be there again this year.
Okay, so that one coming in at 4:30-ish, he comes in on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. All right. Mike, what's it like for you and your fellow pilots, doing a gig like this?
Oh, it's fun. You see all the kids, they come out in there, everybody smiles. It's really exciting. It's a short flight, but it's very exciting. The kids are just happy to do it. It's really a lot of fun.
Okay, and remind us where the proceeds go.
50% go to the Lions Club, and 50% go to the Children's Tumor Fund, neurofibromatosis.
Okay. I imagine people need reservations for this, or how's it work?
It's a first-come, first-served basis.
Oh, okay.
And this year we're only doing 350 seats, correct, Mike?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. We've tried to leave it open in the past, and we've been able to accommodate everybody. Boy, we wear out your pilots.
It gets to be a long night by the time we get the machines put to bed and everybody,
I can imagine.
Yeah.
So when should people start coming out to line up?
It doesn't matter what I say. I can tell them to start coming out at 4 or 4:15, but they'll still be there at 3 o'clock. They all want to be sure they get a ticket.
Okay. Okay. So. And you said it's at the north wing of the airport by Alaska Seaplanes.
Alaska Seaplanes, Gate 1.
Gate 1. And once they get there, where do they go?
They can't miss the table.
Okay.
Yep. There'll be a set up there, and they just pick up the ticket, and they'll get briefed, and at 4:30 we'll start going.
Once Santa gets there.
Yep.
Is there anything special anyone should wear or be aware of for this?
I wouldn't wear any hats that are easily blown off your head, because being out there with the blades running on the machines is kind of dangerous. But we'll cover all of that before they go out there.
Okay. And let's say, the first flight goes off at 4:30. When should people probably stop coming?
I wouldn't say stop coming. We've come to the point where we've come right to the end, and it's worked out perfectly. But once we sell the tickets, then we'll tell people that it's over, and I'm sure there'll be some kind of media coverage, or we'll be able to, personal media or social media, we'll get the word out.
Okay, but it sounds like getting there earlier is better.
Yes.
Correct. Okay. And the one thing to remember is children cannot ride in a parent's lap. They have to be in a seat buckled into the helicopter.
Okay. If people want more information, where can they get it?
Mike, you're using a special line?
Nope, they can call Coastal at 789-5600, and we'll be glad to share the information with them.
Okay. That's the voice of Mike Wilson, GM of Coastal Alaska, and also Donna Hurley's here in the studio, president of the Mendenhall Flying Lions. Is there anything either of you would like to add?
No, come on out. Thank you.
Yeah.
You're welcome. And again, for more information, call Coastal at 789-5600. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Flying machines paint the morning sky. There's a white crescent moon hanging up high, surrounded by blue and the waves rolling. On the sand, the sun shows its face, it shines on the land, shines on the land, shines on the land. Flying machines with broad majestic wings, lines in the sky, I hear them sing. Perfectly designed, these scenes flash by, and they're yours and they're mine. Yesterday's over, time takes its toll. Sweet birds are flying like the wings of my soul. A warm breeze, our eyes to the sky. Feel the ebb and flow of the changing tide. Feel the ebb and flow of the changing tide. Flying machines as we make our way. White moon is speechless, you've nothing to say. Glide, such graceful things. Can't wait to see what tomorrow brings. Can't wait to see what tomorrow brings. Can't wait to see what tomorrow brings. Can't wait to see what tomorrow brings.
Comes from the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping you and your child save for college every step of the way, from diapers to diploma. More information at uacollegesavings.com.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, December 11th. We're right at the bottom of the hour. Scott Burton, your host today, And in the studio with me now is Steve Suwing. He's on the storyboard of Mudrooms. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks. Good to be here. It's warm and dry.
In the Studio A, right?
Yes, it is.
Always sunny in Studio A.
That's right.
All right, so square peg and a round hole tomorrow.
Yeah, I can't believe we're already in December.
Mm-hmm.
And we're four shows into the season. I think people have kind of figured out to some degree or remembered that Mud Rooms is back in session. But, tomorrow night, square peg and a round hole. Our typical lineup, we've got seven folks in the community that have offered to tell a story that fits into this theme. And, it's going to be a great night for storytelling and a great night for community, which Mud Rooms is all about.
That's right. Northern Light United Church, right? How would you describe how to get there if nobody's ever been there?
Well, this is that awesome time of year where the Federal Flats kind of lights up with the spirit of the season. So if you've ever seen that house that has the most lights on it, it's right across the street from 400 West 11th Street, and that's the easiest way. It's like a shining star to find Northern Light Church.
Yeah, right. So you can sort of go towards the Federal Building and wind your way up towards the Governor's Mansion.
Yeah. Take a right there off of 12th, I believe, on B Street is the way to get there. And a lot of folks, have got other places in town that they like to look the lights, but a lot of folks come down for Halloween. So if you know that house, the same one that passes out the full candy bars, you're right across the street from Northern Light Church.
All right, 7 o'clock?
Yeah, 7 o'clock. We like to start promptly. We offer some coaching for our storytellers because getting a story into 7 minutes can be kind of a challenge. And so in that same spirit, we usually start very promptly at 7 o'clock and end very promptly around 8:30.
I know you just had a workshop yesterday, Sunday.
Yeah.
When you were workshopping with people, I understand there's a bunch of folks showed up. What were some of the advice that you gave them? How do you whittle down, say, a 10-minute story to 7 minutes?
Well, there's lots of ways to do it. First of all, we start with people that have been paid to tell stories before. So Tom Cosgrove, who's on the storyboard, is just dedicated to the art of storytelling. And he had two other coaches along there with him who have also told stories. I think both of them have also been paid professionally as well. So I think the first thing you can do for a beginning storyteller is share your story with someone. And, they're going to see how that kind of resonates with them. And I think a lot of times, whether we're at a drinking hole or at a potluck, there's always kind of the right venue to embellish a story and to keep it going as long as possible. And it's kind of the art of it. But getting it into that 7 minutes is really first telling the story to someone, see what resonates with them, and have them offer of, what's going to be valuable in this 7 minutes that they have to tell a story at Mud Rooms, and then just kind of take it from there.
I think I'm hearing editing. Have your story edited, in a sense,
yeah.
Right?
I think so. I've told two stories at Mud Rooms, and I never offered, I never had any help coaching per se, but I was always shocked by how long it actually took to tell a story. And I think really having kind of that definitive kind of hook to pull people into your story, a chance to kind of share the meat of what's happened or kind of the body of it, and a way to kind of close it out is definitely an art form and takes some practice or it takes some professional help. And that's what we did at the workshop this past Sunday.
Will you guys be doing more of those in the future?
I think so. We discussed just before we went on, we're 6.5 years into Mud Rooms. We've got a fairly firm policy that can only tell one story per season. We've got 9 events. And then also we only have 2 veterans per event. We try to stick to that. And so over the course of years, 6.5 seasons in, we've got quite a few folks that have taken that stage and told the story. So we've got lots of veterans, but always looking out for unique ways to reach out and get folks interested in telling their story on the Mudroom stage.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't necessarily need to get coaching or anything to participate, right?
No, you don't. That's helpful if you think you have a definite story to tell, but some of the greatest stories and greatest moments at Mudrooms is when someone's taken the stage and told something that's very deep and personal, and it's just kind of given a window into their soul. Or, we've had many people break down on stage crying. We've had people leave the stage to laughter because of the humor of their story. But I think really the connection part is you get what you put in. So if you take that stage, you offer something that's personal and shares a piece of yourself, you're going to come away with a good experience.
All right, so the theme tomorrow is square peg in a round hole. How do you come up with these themes?
I don't know. You know, last year we were really fortunate. We kind of threw the themes out there at the beginning of the season and had a number of folks sign up pretty quickly. But this year it's been a little bit slower, so we're kind of having some introspection and figuring out kind of what is the best way to come up with these themes. I think the key for us and kind of the learning in our seventh season, we're still learning stuff every season, and I think the key is square peg in a round hole. A lot of, that doesn't resonate with a lot of people, but if we have like a tagline or say, hey, it's a time you were uncomfortable, hey, it's a time you felt out of place, that kind of generates some thoughts for people. So I think the theme's important, but also sometimes a tagline, sometimes the themes can be too broad, and we need some kind of tagline to kind of make it a little bit more specific so people can find a story that's gonna work for them.
Okay. So you're on show number 4 here in December. How many more do you have this season?
Yeah, we've got 5 more shows, so we're almost our midpoint. This event is going to benefit Trail Mix along with the January event. And the proceeds, many of you probably know this already, but we're not a nonprofit. Basically, the folks that are going to be taking the $7 suggested donation at the door are associated with Trail Mix, and that money is going to go directly to their programming. So happy to support them this year.
Okay. So 7 o'clock tomorrow night. Who are some of your readers tomorrow?
Yeah, so our storyteller tomorrow, we've got a veteran, Bob Coghill, who's a very interesting gentleman around town. I recruited him myself. I think he's going to offer up a good story for this. Elizabeth Ellers, Bev Levine, James Brooks of the Juno Empire. Some of you folks might know that name for sure. Rebecca Bell Service and Britt Anderson. Don't want to forget our seventh speaker, Don Gacho.
Okay.
Yeah.
If somebody's never been, how would you describe this event? How would you convince them to come? What is it that keeps you coming back year after year, Steve?
Wow. You know, it just kind of depends on the season and kind of where I'm at in my life. But I think for this season especially, people feel disconnected from one another, their neighbors, their friends, maybe their family. And so for this season, I think really the spirit of community and connection. I've said that many times on the show before, but this is an hour and a half dedicated time where people put their cell phone in their pocket. They're not taking selfies. They're not checking in on their status update. And they really just dedicate to listening to the person on stage offering their story. And I think that the speakers really see that and recognize it, and it feels good. And I think the listeners and the attendees really see that as well. So there's kind of a reciprocal experience. There's also the sense of community before the shows and at our intermission and after. We see many people that don't see each other very frequently for various reasons. It's a time, kind of a center point or an event each month that they can connect.
And speaking of intermission, you have music, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we do have music. Andy Miller is our musician this month, and he'll be playing a couple songs before the event. Doors open at 6, and the show starts promptly at 7, and then during the intermission of about 15 minutes, he'll be playing a couple other songs as well.
And you guys still have, like, snacks and coffee and stuff?
Yeah, great segue. The Rookery and Copa are two businesses here in town that have been supporting Mudrooms pretty much from the start. And so they give us a good break on large cookies and coffee that are available for purchase as well.
Okay. For more information, mudrooms.org, right?
That's right. That's right. And if you want to keep up to date and not forget about when it's coming up and what our themes are, our Facebook page, which is Mudrooms, is also a great place to connect with us as well.
All right. That's the voice of Steve Sue Wing on the storyboards, Mudroom Storyboard. Steve, is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, the last thing I'd like to add is, like I said, the benefits from this event, our next event, basically 4 events for the season, are going to Trail Mix. And over the last 6.5 years, we've donated to a bunch of nonprofits in this town. And the thing that keeps Mudrooms going is storytellers. So maybe you're a member of Trail Mix. Maybe you're on the board. Maybe you're the executive director. But folks that are really tied to Trail Mix, it would be great to see them volunteer for our next event. I think we've got one or two more spots. But there's so many nonprofits that have benefited from this event. It would be great if some of those folks that have benefited or are connected to them step up and decide to tell a story on the Mudroom stage, because we've got more than enough spaces for newcomers.
Any guesstimate how much money you guys have raised over the years?
You know, before I get here, it's usually a chance for me to check in. But over the last 6.5 years, I can safely say it's about $86,000.
Wow.
Yeah. So
very cool.
Thank you, Juno, and thank you to everyone that supports Mudrooms.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, December 11th, about 15 minutes till the top of the hour. Scott Burton, your host, and Steve's still in the studio with me. We have a few extra minutes on the show today, so we went to the vault and found Guy Archibald's story from, what show was it, Steve?
You're putting me on the spot.
Was it If I Only Listened, maybe?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yep. It's one. I've missed two of the shows this year, and that's one of them.
Well, so. Here we get to listen to the story.
That's right.
On K2 Public Media.
Great segue. at mudrooms.org, all of our stories are archived. If you like Guy's story or know someone that's told a story in the past, that's a good way to access it. I failed to mention that this evening at 7 o'clock at KTO 104.3, there's going to be some mudroom stories aired. And I don't want to say it's the best of the best, but it's just some stories that, as a storyboard, that kind of jumped out to us, and we put that together in a show, and it's of the first 5 years of mudrooms. So tonight at 7, that's going to be airing, and it's absolutely the perfect weather out this evening to grab a cup of eggnog, make sure it's warm, sit by the monitor of the stove, and listen to the show at 7 o'clock.
Otherwise, come out tomorrow for the live event at 7 o'clock.
Do both things. I think you should prioritize those.
Here's Guy Archibald.
Our next one is Guy Archibald. Guy Archibald is a mountain boy originally from Colorado. He thinks life is one big experiment. You don't know until you give it a try. So try everything.
So I used to work at a mine way out in the desert of southeastern Utah. Beautiful country, red slip rock, canyons, sage, pinyon pines. And we'd work a schedule of 10 days working and then 4 days off. But there really wasn't anything to do on your 4 days off. The nearest anything was a one-building town 81 miles away called Fry Canyon. But from the mine camp off on the horizon, I could see this large ridge that stuck up. It looked like a clenched fist. And I knew that Lake Powell was just on the other side of that ridge. So I made up my mind, such as it was, that I was going to hike there sometime. Now, to go back a little, for many years, I was a member of a mountain search and rescue team. And they drill into your head the two rules of going into the wilderness. First of all, you tell somebody where you're going and when you're going to come back. And second of all, you bring some essentials in case you end up out there longer than you planned. And we had to drill that into a lot of other people's heads. So one day, I set off across the desert towards my clenched fist. No matches, no food, no water, and I hadn't told a soul. So I'm walking across basically this big plateau, beautiful desert. I go a few miles, and I come across this big chasm in front of me, this huge crevasse in the earth. It's hundreds of feet deep, 100 feet wide or so. And right where I intersected it, there was a ledge down below, about 15-foot drop below, a big ledge with some pinions growing on it and yuccas and greasewood, and I couldn't see over the edge. Looked like if I could get down, I could climb out the other side, continue on my way. So I walked up the canyon about a mile, and I'm looking and looking. Nope, no way down. I come back to the same spot, and no, I still can't see over the edge. So I walk down the canyon about a mile, looking and looking. Nope, can't find a way down. So I came back to that spot, and I decided I'll just jump down there, look over the edge. So I did. Jumped down there, landed in the soft sand. I walked over to the edge, and I looked down. Nope. And then I looked behind me. Uh-oh. Now I know what a spider feels like in a bathtub. In the parlance of the desert, it's called being potholed. So now I get to entertain myself by cycling through the five stages of grief here. So first there's denial. I'm not stuck. I'm going to get out of here. So I'd get back as far as I could, and I would run, and I would leap, and I'd throw myself against the rock, and I'd claw and scramble and scratch like a cat being suspended over water. And every time I'd slide down and land in a heap, a little bit softer piece of meat every time. And I did this over and over again. And then there was anger. Man. And then there's bargaining. Please, God. Oh, Lord, I promise I'll be a good, oh, maybe a better person if you just get me out. And then there's depression. Let's see what's going to get me first. Dehydration, starvation, exposure. And then, of course, acceptance. Someday, somebody's going to come along this lonely spot and they're going to look down there. And here's a skeleton with some tattered remains of clothing leaning up against the rock. And I cycled through this for the next 7-8 hours, spending a little more time on one or the other. Became very good at them all. Obviously, I got off the ledge. And the way I did it was, there was a little pinyon pine about 10 feet tall next to the rock, and I climbed up in the top of that thing. And I'd start swinging it back and forth and back and forth. And at the right moment, I'd throw myself out of the tree and onto the rock. And I'd scramble and scratch. And I'd come down and I'd land in a big wad in between the tree and the rock. And I did this over and over again, fueled by just increasing desperation. Finally, I got just enough of a toehold where I could scramble up. I got just enough friction where I could take that one step necessary to climb off of this ledge and get out of this whole pothole. Sometimes listening is not enough. And as I'm dragging my now tenderized body back across the desert, it dawns on me that if we as humans actually listened to people, if we actually learned from others' experience and did not have to repeat the same mistakes, we would have colonized the universe by now. But if that collective we is represented by me, the universe is a very lucky place.
That was Guy Archibald from the November 2017 Mudrooms. If I'd only listened, you can hear that and other stories at mudrooms.org.
This is Bird Note. How do pelicans catch fish? There are two kinds of pelicans in North America, the white and the brown, and they've evolved different tactics to capture their prey. White pelicans form a group, swim in a line, and while herding a school of fish, all dip their heads at once. The white pelican's broad bill spreads its huge pouch as the bird pushes through the water. As each bird lifts its head, water drains out of the pouch and the fish go down with a gulp. These pelicans breed on western lakes and winter on shallow salt water. Brown pelicans capture fish from above without warning. Brown pelicans are smaller than white and fly along our coasts in flocks. Their bills are narrow, so they can cleave the deeper ocean water in a dive. When they spot a fish, they plummet straight down, and the pouch opens to engulf the prey. Fortunately, though both species have been declining, even rare at times, conservation has helped, and their numbers have increased. Today's show brought to you by the Lufkin Family Foundation. You can form a line with your friends or dive solo to gulp down more info about pelicans at our website, birdnote.org. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juneau afternoon. It's currently 43 degrees out at the Juneau International Airport, and the forecast for tonight calls for rain with lows around 43 degrees and southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Chance of precip's about 100%. Tuesday calls for showers mainly before 3 p.m., high near 44. Chance of precipitation 100%. Wednesday calls for rain, then rain could be, the rain could be heavy at times with a high near 48. Chance of precipitation 100%. And Thursday, rain likely mainly before 3 p.m. and cloudy with a high near 42. Chance of precipitation drops to 70%. Thanks for tuning in to a Juneau afternoon.